A very good morning to everyone. The next case is Matriciano against Walker. Mr. Feldman.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Howard Feldman. I represent the appellant, Ronald Matriciano. In 1996, this court held in Shimmer versus Washington that a policy of the Department of Corrections of the state of Illinois that prohibited employees from speaking to the Prisoner Review Board was subject to challenge. No rule such exists at the department, and in 2002, Ronald Matriciano, in December, testified before the Prisoner Review Board concerning the release of a particular inmate. Prior to making that presentation, he had advised the director of the department, as well as the assistant director, and had taken a day off, traveled and attended the Prisoner Review Board, and gave a statement. Prior to that date, Mr. Matriciano had been a longtime civil servant of the Department of Corrections, both in exempt positions, in other words, positions that were not coded by civil service, and in coded positions. At the time of his speaking under the Prisoner Review Board, he held the position of Assistant Deputy Director. The Assistant Deputy Director position was not exempt, was a fully civil service position covered by all of the jurisdictions of the civil service. After he gave his testimony, within 24 hours, he had in fact spoken with the director of the department. Although the director suggests otherwise, the assistant director, Mr. Detella, was present, had spoken with the director, and gave the phone and heard Mr. Matriciano's side of that conversation. Additional responsibilities were afforded to Mr. Matriciano at that time because of a reduction in staff at the department due to early retirements. Approximately 6 or 7 days later, on about December 23rd to 24th, 2002, Mr. Matriciano's testimony before the Prisoner Review Board became subject of some newspaper articles. Shortly thereafter, Mr. Matriciano's employment status changed. Although holding the same pay grade, he was transferred from being an assistant deputy director to being in charge of being assigned to an empty facility. That change in employment status was viewed by Mr. Detella as a demotion and was viewed by Sergio Molina, the department spokesman, and was quoted to the paper as being a demotion.
It did not affect his rate of compensation, am I correct?
That's correct. He still held the same pay for at least that period of time until he was laid off.
I see. Now, how does one get appointed to that position of
Assistant Deputy Director?
Deputy Director.
I assume the director appoints you. It indicated to me that it was Rutan exempt, looking at the documents, but I'm not sure that was not subject to the litigation, but I don't believe it was a posting.
I noticed that in the briefs, but you just said it's a full civil service.
It covers the full scope of the Civil Service Commission. There's a number of things that are unusual in the Illinois Personnel Code, to say the least.
What kind of rights did he have in the event of discharge?
In the event of discharge, if he had been discharged from the position, he could have appealed to the Civil Service Commission, which, to be honest with you, Your Honors, why I believe that he wasn't discharged is because they didn't have a basis to discharge. He'd given testimony on his day off after getting advance notice. What he was done is, and it's my understanding of the case law, is that you don't need to have a diminution of pay. You don't have to be discharged to be able to state a First Amendment claim, that you need to have a change of employment status. And I believe a change of employment status where the department spokesman goes out and announces to the to the world that you've been demoted constitutes a change of employment status, as I understand the current status of the law. After that occurred, there was a series of other matters that I don't think are germane to the motion for summary judgment. The motion for summary judgment was effectively granted because the trial court believed that Mr. Matriciano was a policy-making position, therefore didn't have certain First Amendment rights, or the First Amendment rights were reduced because of the position. And this was under the analysis as described under the Pickering case. As fate would always have it, after we had filed our initial brief and the trial court had reviewed the matter, the Pickering case became subject to somewhat of a review in a later decision and most recent decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in this area in Garcetti.
How do you think Garcetti affects your case?
I believe that Garcetti takes away the balancing test, the test that I think we're successful either way, but under the balancing test, we would look at the rights of the employer versus the rights of the employee, and I would suggest there's absolutely nothing in the record other than the fact that there was a press story about the testimony at the Prisoner Review Board, a public hearing, that would indicate there was any impact on the department at all.
And in your view, what does the Garcetti case replace?
The Garcetti case would replace it with, you look at his is that what he does? You look at the nature of his job. And if you look at his job description, is that it doesn't indicate that he is, in fact, responsible for establishing testimony for the Prisoner Review Board. That's not one of his duties or obligations. And even in Garcetti, one of the things they talked about in Garcetti is that there wasn't litigation over the actual job duties. And I think that's... There are cases, I think, that are really pivotal to the government side of the case, to Mr. Snyder and Mr. Walker's position, and those relate to two cases involving dismissal of a warden and an assistant warden, and they talk about policy making. And both of those cases that recently decided by this court addressed the fact that their job descriptions were not subject to litigation. Well, all the litigation in this case sort of revolved around whether or not he was a policymaker, pretty obviously because Garcetti hadn't been decided at that point. And with regard to the policymaking, they indicate that they are a policymaker. They look at the position statement, and they say he's a policymaker, and they look at the fact that he's higher than a warden in a hierarchy, in a reporting hierarchy, so therefore he has to be a policymaker because wardens are policymaker. Except the warden is an exempt employee. An assistant deputy director is not. Mr. Detella, the assistant director, gave an affidavit saying he wasn't a policymaker. Nancy Miller, who was the then policy person for the department, high-ranking person, said he didn't have the authority to make policy. Policy decisions at the Illinois Department of Corrections are very structured. It is a paramilitary organization. Individuals can't make policy. And in the testimony and part of the summary judgment information is that in talking to other assistant deputy directors, when asked if they could make policy, they said no. And then when asked, well, it's just like a member of the public, you have a right to give your input. And the answer to that was yes. In other words, what the Schimmer case talked about was the ability to be able to provide information to the Prisoner Review Board.
And can you go more into the facts of Schimmer? Because obviously that has an impact on qualified immunity. And I understand your position that it's too late for them to raise qualified immunity.
Well, even if they did, there's a memorandum of the department, the department's lawyer that the director had, that said, you can't do this. Schimmer, there was no rule or regulation. Schimmer was basically on a dismissal of a challenge to a then-existing rule that prohibited testimony before the Prisoner Review Board. the court, the Seventh Circuit said in 96, gee, you've got to apply the Pickering test, so you can't just make it an absolute ban before you get started. Go back and do a rule. I am not suggesting that the department could not have come up or designed a rule. They chose not to. They did nothing. And quite honestly, the courts have said, gee, when you look at a prisoner, when you're talking about somebody coming up for parole, and we don't have a lot of people left that are doing indeterminate sentence, but where you have somebody coming up for parole, part of the information you have may be something that went on in the institution. Guards, wardens, counselors, educators. People would be able to provide information to the decision maker to allow them to make the decision. What occurred here, quite simply, wasn't that Mr. Matriciano was testifying before the Prisoner Review Commission. It is that, in fact, the testimony before the Prisoner Review Committee, the content of what he said, became subject to a press article which could have impacted the reappointment of the then director or acting director of the Department of Corrections. This was in spite. This is going to cause me a problem, and I don't know whether it did or it didn't, but this was his concern, so he's got to go because I've got to make a statement.
And Schimmer, though, is the only case that really speaks to this issue of Schimmer, the right to speak at the Prison Review Board.
As directly as it is, yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, this became controversial because of the notorious status of this particular prisoner as a mob hitman who had bribed a judge.
Well, Your Honor, that's not what he was convicted of. He was convicted of the bribery of the judge. He was not convicted of being a mob hitman. He was convicted of, I believe, a homicide or two. He had served a long sentence. I'm not speaking for or against the particular persons, but, you know,
how long had he been in the state system at the time that your client gave this testimony?
He'd been in the state system a relatively short time, a couple of years, maybe right. A little bit more. But
isn't that also part of what raised eyebrows about your client's participation before the parole board?
Your Honor, it may very well have been. I'm not saying it wasn't a news story, but what I'm suggesting is speech is easy to protect as long as it's not controversial. As long as you say what people want you to hear, speech is protectable.
My questions go to the interest of the institution in maintaining order and discipline and also the appearance of some separation between the prisoners and those who guard them.
Well, that would always be the case, and therefore a blanket bar would
appear. Well, it's particularly the case involving an inmate who is convicted of an obstruction of justice sort of crime, giving rise to the inference that he would do it again with one of his guards, which your client wasn't a guard. He was far higher up in the system.
He was far higher up, and he took a day off, and he gave his opinion as to what it was.
What's the status of the criminal case that your client is now under indictment for?
Your Honor, it's been continued, and Your Honor, the court knows that had I seen the court's decision on motion to strike, I would have not filed a motion to strike, trust me. But that decision has no bearing on this civil case whatsoever.
Why not?
Well, then this case should not go forward until that case is resolved, because, Your Honor, I have some fairly strong feelings about an office that pursues a criminal case at the same time it's defending a civil case. It's not as if it was a rule of necessity. Most of the state prosecutions are resolved by local state's attorneys in the 102 counties in this state.
Let me try to get at what I think Judge Sykes is trying to. She's raising certain facts. I guess I'm trying to decide why the employer's interests shouldn't weigh more heavily here if we use Pickering as the test. And for some of the reasons articulated by Judge Sykes, because we are in a weighing situation.
Right. If there was some testimony that had caused some problem, are we talking that it was a press story for a day? If in fact, somebody gets transferred or dismissed for every press story, there'd be a lot of movement. I mean, the papers are filled with press stories every day. There is no impact. They cannot, And there is no evidence in the record of any problems with the department, period. There's no indication. This didn't come from the assistant deputy director. This came from an acting director seeking reappointment in a new administration. This, no one can point to this caused a problem in the institution. And it's, you know, you anytime, if he had been a rapist, not just a person that had been involved in serial rapes that were controversial in an area, but 20 years later, he had served longer than people who have similar, I'm past my time, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Feldman, your last few minutes were taken up with questions, so I will give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very
much,
Your Honor.
And I will give your opposing counsel 2 more minutes as well.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Mary Welsh. I'm here on behalf of the defendants, Director Snyder and Director Walker. Your Honors, this Court has said said in Riley that sometimes it is no mean feat to determine whether a particular position is a policymaking one for First Amendment purposes. Here, however, because of this Court's decision in Riley and the decision in Pearson, it's not a difficult task. This Court has already determined that an assistant warden and a warden, by virtue of their job descriptions, is a policymaker for First Amendment purposes. And because of that, as the District Court found, it really doesn't make sense to then say, oh, yes, the warden and the assistant warden are policymakers for First Amendment purposes, but not the position that's above them, that is to say the assistant deputy director, which was Mr. Matriciano's position. And how do we know this? Well, we look at the job description. And the job description says, says exactly, explicitly, it's Exhibit 30 in Document 46, it says, reviews and audits policies, develops policies and procedures in the program areas. Now, counsel is suggesting that because Mr. Matriciano did not make policy, he's not a policymaker. Well, that can't be true, because policymaking for First Amendment purposes is about meaningful input.
Counsel, if I could just interrupt for a minute, that's only part of the analysis under mm-hmm. the policymaker exception, and I think it's fairly self-evident that the assistant deputy director, I think that's his exact title of the Department of Corrections, is a policymaking position, mm-hmm. since, as you have pointed out, this Court has held positions several steps below that to be policymaking positions. Mm-hmm. The speech in question here had nothing to do with his policymaking role. The speech in question, in fact, was well outside of it. So why is the policymaker exception even in play in this case?
Well, I think, Your Honor, as the Court has said, there's a lot of overlap between the policymaker and the second prong of the Pickering analysis. And so what you do is you balance, in the second part of the Pickering analysis, you balance the interests of the speaker against the institution employer's interests in restricting the speech. And to also address the Court's question about Garcetti and how that affected Pickering, as I read Garcetti, it didn't do away with the Pickering test because it concerned the first prong of the Pickering test, which is whether the speech is protected at all. And what the Court said in Garcetti was that if you are speaking pursuant to your job duties, then your speech isn't protected, so you don't even reach the second prong of the Pickering test. But here, of course, we do reach the second prong of the Pickering test, even though there is the policymaker, even though the plaintiff's a policymaker, because for particular people, for high-level people, for policy informers, for people who have the director's ear, if you will, who have a confidential relationship. And remember, Mr. Matriciano was number 3 or 4, because the number 3 above him actually had retired when he took his position. So he was, in effect, the number 3 person at the department. He was very high up.
And so what policy did his testimony contradict? You know, the sense I have is that mm-hmm. your position is that any time a high-level corrections employee testifies in favor of an inmate's release, there's no First Amendment protection.
No.
You know, tell me what is the policy that you think his testimony contradicted?
Your Honor, it's not just that there's a policy. I don't think the second prong of the Pickering analysis requires a direct conflict between policy decisions. It's not like the cases in which, a principal has a difference of opinion with the board about a spending decision or that. What it does here is it calls into question the judgment. And again, that's what the department's position here was, that this was displayed very poor judgment on Mr. Matriciano's part to make a public statement, not just put it in writing in his file, which again, by the way, is about Scheimer. Scheimer, and that was my case, so I know it pretty well, Scheimer did not even address the Pickering analysis. It was about Turner analysis and how much the prison's policies, penological interests weigh in here. So that was not a Pickering case. Similarly, Paul was not a Pickering case. So again, to go back to the court's question about how did this relate to his job? Well, as Judge Sykes mentioned, I mean, this was a statement in support of a person who had obstructed justice, who had bribed a judge in his bench trial, and who was found to have bribed a judge in his bench trial, who was found to have been a murderer, was convicted and sentenced to 100 to 300 years, and suddenly the number three person in the office is coming to bat very publicly for this.
He's not in the prosecutor's office, though. He's in the office of the person who has custodian, who is the custodian of the prisoner pursuant to a court order. What business is it of his boss whether that man is released or is not released? That's not his job in government, is it?
No, it's not his job, but it certainly relates to his job because, again, this is about Mr. Matriciano was in a position where he was making meaningful input as a policymaker into Department of Corrections.
It seems to me that the director, in taking the action he did, is making policy ultra vires, too, because he is depriving the parole board of extremely pertinent information, and he has no legal right to do that. The law, there's no law that allows him to do that.
Your Honor, the director didn't prevent Mr. Matriciano from giving the parole board this information.
No,
we can be sure that there'll be no other deputy assistant director who's going to speak in favor, at least, of release. There'll probably be some who will speak against release, but no one will dare speak in favor from now on, right?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that. I mean, certainly, and as far as I know, actually, and it's not in the record, but as far as I know, it's extremely rare that a corrections employee does speak in favor of a particular inmate. And again,
is there any regulation in the Department of Corrections about who may speak to the parole, about whether custodians can speak to the parole board?
To my knowledge, there's no current explicit rule, although as counsel suggested, there was a legal opinion circulated among from the general counsel's office among the upper level people that explained that it is a matter of public concern, so it passes the first prong of Pickering, but it didn't address the memo, which is in the record, did not address the particular person with regard to a particular person and whether particular people could speak out.
Well, this situation is very perplexing because the plaintiff actually went to Snyder and the board members before he testified, told them he was going to testify on behalf of Edelman, and he received no opposition. Nobody hinted, suggested, inferred. I mean, didn't say, you have a right to do this, but it could be problematic because how it might be perceived. We might have nobody says anything. And then this happens down the road. I mean, it appears as if he was almost set up.
Well, Your Honor, I have a couple of answers to that. One is that from the record, it's I can't see anything in the record that says, I told these people I was going to speak on behalf of Edelman. It says, and Edelman is a particular case. I mean, this is not some mope who, you know, knocked off a liquor store and didn't kill anybody and, you know, is near the end of his term. I mean, this is a guy who has a history of violence violence and bribery behind him. But, again, if he did speak explicitly about Edelman, and if he understood that he got an okay from this, his relief is not a First Amendment case. The relief he should be seeking is a state court claim for detrimental reliance. I mean, this is not the realm of the First Amendment. Not only is he a policymaker, when a policymaker makes a misstep of this magnitude, that's the kind of thing that then you start to say, what are the interests of the employer and what are the interests of the person?
Does the parole board have subpoena power in the state of Illinois?
I don't know. I can check.
Because if it did, wouldn't it be interesting if they subpoenaed someone like this and does the director have the legal authority to tell them not to come and not to speak, or at least not to say anything favorable?
My understanding of subpoenas, which is pretty limited, would be that if you have a subpoena and you're called to testify, you do that unless you have some, like, Fifth Amendment problem or so.
Can we get back to the factual context?
Sure.
Because as I understand it, plaintiff discussed with Snyder the possibility that the plaintiff would testify at the hearing. Snyder told him it was his decision, but to make sure the Prison Review Board didn't have a problem with him testifying. The plaintiff then contacted members of the Prisoner Review Board, although he couldn't remember how many, and they all said they didn't have a problem with him testifying.
Right, and I do see...
And Miller, chief of the Bureau of Operations, actually reviewed his statement in advance, and his statement was in favor of Edelman.
Mm-hmm. Right, but that actually doesn't appear in Ms. Miller's affidavit that she reviewed it, but you see in the rest of those statements, those are Mr. Matriciano's statements, and Ailman's name never appears in that. So I don't know from the record whether he spoke, that he said just, I'm talking about a high-profile person, which is the term that's often used, or Ailman in particular. But again, we have to think about the Pickering balancing test. You have to balance the First Amendment rights, the right to speak. And again, there are various ways that the plaintiff could have spoken. He could have just submitted a written statement to the PRB. That's what Scheimer says under Turner. And then there probably would not have been this big brouhaha. But once all of this happened, there again the courts have to give a certain amount of deference. That's what this court said in Bond. You have to defer to an employer's concerns about credibility. You know that now the judgment.
Lawyer here who never bothered to enact any kind of administrative. He certainly has a lot of directives, but he never bothered to issue one to his employees about this matter and said, you don't do this. This will be detrimental to good order and discipline. Never did.
Right. Well, Your Honor, I think after Scheimer, the department was precluded from doing that because in Scheimer, this court said that under Turner that we hadn't presented a significant penological interest to bar that. So I believe that the department was still, you know, trying to assess and the policy and doing it more on a one-on-one question. But even if there were a First Amendment violation here, the defendants would have qualified immunity. And I know the court was questioning, or I understood the court to be questioning whether we could raise qualified immunity on appeal. But it's certainly well established that that an appellee can raise anything in the record in order to argue in support of a judgment. And here, qualified immunity was raised in the district court below. And certainly, after you look at Pearson and after you look at Riley, it would and the notion that a job description is a provisional safe harbor with regard to, as this court said in Riley, I believe it was, for an employer restricting the rights, the First Amendment rights of an employee, then certainly not every reasonable director of a corrections department would have been on notice that a that to limit the speech of a very high-level person that was in support of a really a notorious inmate would be unconstitutional. I mean, that's just not possible.
What does our case law say about raising qualified immunity for the first time on appeal?
Oh, no, we didn't raise it for the first time, Your Honor. We raised it below.
You did?
Yeah.
I thought you said you did, and that's why I questioned.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. No, we did raise it below. It's in the record. It's not. And again, I mean, plaintiff's case on this said you can't attack a judgment and you can't expand a judgment if you don't cross appeal. Well, we're not attacking the judgment. We won, after all, and we're not trying to expand it. All we're trying to do is to give the court a second option for affirming the judgment in the defendant's favor. So in closing, unless the court has questions, because the plaintiff, according to his job description, obviously had policymaking input. He is a policymaker, which perhaps brings him within almost a categorical exception, as this court has discussed in Bonds, to the Pickering analysis. But even if you do go to the second prong of the Pickering analysis, it's plain that the employer's, the director's interest in restricting speech about particularly high-profile, violent, bribing inmates would outweigh the First Amendment right to publicly speak. And remember, Mr. Matriciano, although he took the day off, his statement is replete with references to his position at the department. He says, I'm the assistant deputy director. I have done this for years. I know everything about inmates. And his connection with Ailman was short-lived and years before the parole hearing took place. So he's not like the guards in Hall or in Scheimer. Those guards had day-to-day direct contact with the inmate in question. And so, again, this is a question where you balance the interests of the department and the directors against the interests of the Mr. Matriciano. And this court has said when an employer says that expresses a reasonable fear that this will cause dissension or questions of credibility and good judgment to arise, that the court has to give deference to the employer's concerns in that regard. And because of that, this court should find that the defendants did not violate that the district court was correct in granting summary judgment for the defendants on the merits. And even if the defendants were not entitled to judgment on the merits of the claim, they certainly were entitled to judgment on qualified immunity. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Welch. Mr. Feldman, I believe your time had expired, but you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very quickly, Ailman had been in an institution for more than 30 years. 2, can't sue the state. Everybody knows you can't sue the state. The only way you sue the state is through the 1983 action. You come in here. 3, just because he's a higher position on an organization chart doesn't automatically make him a policymaker. In fact, he is a certified employee of the Department of Corrections. The warden and assistant warden are not. Line versus staff functions.
Yeah, but you're not dealing with the job description, and counsel pointed out some factors that clearly suggest they determine policy.
They just like a person out, a law enforcement officer who makes decisions every day, is implementing policy. He did implement policy. He did not make policy. And that goes to both Riley and Pearson, which are Elrod Branty cases, not First Amendment speech cases. Now, it's still First Amendment, but they are First Amendment termination political cases. And both of those made great care in saying nobody's challenging the job description. And
Counsel, what your client did here is highly suggestive of corruption, regardless of how the criminal case comes out.
Judge,
and why is it not the case that the state has a very strong interest in disciplining conduct and speech like this that is highly suggestive of corruption for the good of the institution?
Judge Sykes, first, I'm somewhat a little speechless about the raising the criminal charge, because in our response,
I said regardless of how the criminal charges come out,
but
taking
the fact
at face value what your client
that was
did,
not before the trial court. That we filed a motion.
It's a matter of public record.
We filed a motion in this
summary
court.
Summary judgment is de novo. If you would just address my question.
One, there is no evidence of corruption. There's not a shred of it before the trial court in this case.
What your client did is highly suggestive of corruption because of the nature, the notorious status of this prisoner, because of the limited amount of time that he had been in this in the state's custody, because of the limited amount of contact your client would have had with him, and because of your client's high-level position. It is on its face highly suggestive of corruption. That's why it got all the media attention.
Your Honor, first, that he saw him not just at the time that he was brought back into the institution, and the testimony was he was assigned to Mr. Aylman to allow him to be incorporated into the
If you
the
would
state
address
system.
My question of the state's interest
the state's
in avoiding
interest.
Even the appearance of corruptibility of its high-level employees for the good of the institution.
I believe, and let me finish, because I think this court's addressed it. If you can. I'm going to read from Sharmick. That'd be the last suggestion I do, and it's the best answer I've got. In the last paragraphs of Scheimer, it says, although we remain acutely aware of our remove from the day-to-day logistics of managing a prison, we suggest that perhaps our insistence on some evidence of support, some evidence to support this policy, and this is the policy prohibiting testimony, will provide the prison administration with an opportunity to review its current ban on direct communications between prison guards and the board. We recognize that prison populations are burgeoning, and we imagine clemency petitions to be increasing at a commensurate rate. With expanded opportunity in the future, letters from prison guards written directly to the prison review board, could arguably both inform the board and provide an incentive for model prisoner behavior. On the heels of this observation, we hasten to add that such policymaking consistent with the law is, of course, wholly in the hands of prison administration. It is not necessary that we agree with the prison administration's chosen course, but only that we are able to point some rational basis to it. Your Honor, they didn't, from 1996 until this happened, and I would suggest until today, they still have not established any rule or policy or established in any court any rational basis. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Feldman. So we want to thank both counsel for their fine presentations today, and the case will be taken under advisement.